Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast and our first ever live Mad Tech Podcast episode. Yeah, you will hear the audio behind us. For the benefit of our listeners who are listening on their chosen audio platforms, I would like to introduce myself. I'm Lindsay Rowntree. I'm head of content at Exchange Wire. And the format of the podcast will be largely unchanged, but there'll be a couple of tweaks. For example, we have more guests. We have a live audience, and we will still be looking at news of the week, but it'll be focused on a particular theme, and that theme this week is the future of identity, looking beyond the cookie. So I would like to hand over to my guests and get them introduced themselves. Let's start with you, Badir.
Yep, I'm Badir Ademir. I'm the head of audience and data at News UK.
My name's Danny Hopwood. I'm president at Digital Display at Omnicom Media Group Europe.
Nick Housted, the founder and CEO of InfoSum.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. So our first news story of the week is, and I've got my notes here, I have to read this out because it's a very, very long thing. So the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee's 18-month investigation into disinformation and fake news has decided that Facebook are digital gangsters. There's lots of, it's generally Kieran doing the booing if you hadn't guessed already. But it was a long report. There are lots of findings from it. It was a 111-page report. But two key findings were that Facebook are digital gangsters and that the British government is not equipped to deal with the self-regulation of large tech platforms. A couple of key quotes from the report, largely around Facebook. Companies like Facebook should not be allowed to behave like digital gangsters in the online world, considering themselves to be ahead of and beyond the law. Facebook has built its company in a way that makes data abuses easy. And it went into a lot of detail about the kind of company, the current lawsuit in the US, kind of the company called 643, and how people were paying extra to be able to have access not only to data they had access to, but the friend's data and friends of friends' data. So there's a lot of information around data in that. And it just highlights, again, kind of what the kinds of different scandals that Facebook's going through. I'm fascinated on your thoughts of the report. I'm not expecting you to have read it all, of course, but what it means for Facebook going forward. Are they Teflon, or will they start to kind of start seeing cracks, particularly with the UK government pressing on them so hard?
Well, it's from my point of view, 2 years ago, I got asked to engage with government around this because of my background around building social network data licensing. I found out that actually 2 years ago, and I don't think it's changed now, that government has a total of two people in the department that looks after this space. Now, how many people look after TV, newspapers, etc.? Just over 1,000 people are employed across the three agencies that look after the rest of the world. And if you look at the media spend across TV publishers versus what the advertising spend across social networks, about equal. So you've got two people that are looking at regulating social networks versus 1,000. So, you know, there's two sides to this. Facebook clearly, lost control of what's happening with their platform and certainly around what's happening with the data. But government is just as much, you can't regulate that with two people, can you?
I think as well, you just have to look around at your political representative for your town or village or city and just question yourself, are they going to be able to confidently argue for my rights or the legalities around data usage for me? Because my answer is no. My representative in Welwyn Garden City absolutely couldn't do that. And that's a problem with our government, that there's probably some people in there who are illiterate in the world of digital that we spend most of our life within right now.
Yeah, and I think there's a problem with how Facebook, frame themselves. And with my publisher background, they say that they're not responsible for what goes on their platform. And, that's a fundamental issue. And I think one of the things that came up in this report, or one of the other reports, there seems to have been many that reference Facebook in the last couple of weeks. Was that do they need to redefine what Facebook is? Do they even need to create a new classification for people like Facebook so that they have to take some responsibility for what appears on their platform? Now, I would argue absolutely yes, they do. Because, it's all well and good taking all of the revenue for the content that appears on their platform. So they monetize it without passing any of that back to the originators of that content. But then they don't take any responsibility for the harm that might cause. And so there does need to be a reclassification for people like Facebook, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. And people like Facebook, who would you put in there?
They would class themselves as sort of aggregators and platform and content distributors. And there's a few of them, and you'd even argue that something like Alexa is potentially the same thing, and we're going to see the same problems. You know, I think again, just the other week, Google was asking publishers if they could break their podcasts down into manageable chunks so that they can be discoverable via search. There was absolutely no mention as to how they might monetize that. So again, publishers are being asked to provide the content, which will then be used for data and for monetization by a platform such as you know, Amazon or Google, with no sort of compensation for the creators of that. So there's going to be numerous, you know, this is ongoing, and clearly those guys are not changing that business model. They're going to look for other ways to do that going forward.
And I mean, the Facebooks of the world know that. Are they, you know, is that putting publishers over a barrel, basically? They're going, well, we know that you're going to have to do what we ask you to do, you know, bet the devil you know kind of thing, and you guys will have to go, okay, fine, we will break up our podcast into chunks for you.
Well, do we? I mean, I don't know. Lots of publishers, you know, built up the business. There was that old model of, you know, build it and then monetize it. And I think, you know, both Facebook and Twitter sort of started on that route, get the numbers and then figure out how to monetize them. Publishers have been trying to do the same thing, but now it's very, very clear that advertising alone is not going to save publishers. They need to look at other ways of monetizing. So if suddenly scale is not the be all and end all, then is our reliance on someone like Facebook so necessary? You know, does it matter if we're not hitting such huge reach, if it means that we can get back control of our readers and sort of reclaim that relationship with our content? So, I mean, don't get me wrong, we will all still work with people like Facebook and Google and Amazon, but I think we need to sort of redefine what those boundaries are and start to ask some quite difficult questions of ourselves as to why are we doing this, why are we giving this away, and what do we actually want in return?
And Danny, I'm interested in your perspective on that from sitting on the buy side. Like, do you think that there's a lot of talks around, you know, advertisers will start seeing what they truly are, reducing their budgets and then putting them elsewhere, but then other people are saying, no, they're untouchable. People will still invest in Facebook because actually what Facebook is able to offer the advertiser isn't that bad.
I think the advertiser is becoming a lot more in depth in terms of their scrutiny of Facebook. Like, a lot of the questions that we're having with advertisers right now, or that they're posing to us to then ask to Facebook on their behalf, are like the granularities of like, how are they handling their data? When a client spends money with Facebook, is that money a safe investment? Is it going to end up biting them in the, you know, in the behind at some point in the future if they found out that Facebook is actually breaking or infracting any legalities or politics? So clients are becoming a little bit more scrutinous around it. I think I don't really see a decline of, you know, desire of spending money with Facebook, though. I just see the desire for a more knowledgeable answer on is Facebook the right place for my money? And this comes, you know, primarily from Facebook, who then invest a lot of money in resourcing the teams that need to give those responses to clients. Like, I think if you looked on Facebook's hiring for the past 2 years, like, you would see most of their hiring being around people who can have these conversations with clients, teams that can respond on the right legal requirements for these clients. So they are investing in that area. Is that going to solve the problem of what we talk about day in, day out, and that there's a lack of control with publishers or a lack of control just in general the industry with these type of companies? No.
Because they're asking Facebook to tell them that they can trust Facebook.
Totally.
And that's kind of the government's point, right? Like,
yep.
Actually, that's, again, self-regulation. That's marking your own homework. Who else out there can be that advisor to the advertiser and the publisher as well to say, this is what Facebook are standing for, this is what you can and should and shouldn't do with them?
I think there's lots of boutique-y consultancies who would like that role. But I don't know if that's right either.
No, maybe not. Maybe not. And Nick, what's your take on this? Kind of sitting, you know, in the data layer, and obviously Facebook are lauded for their data, but they're also chastised for their data very, very heavily, and rightly so in many cases. Kind of, what are your take on how they're being treated for their abuses of data?
Well, you know, it's the bottom line is any platform like that's, you know, gonna, it's still a wild west. You know,
yeah.
they without regulation, they're going to do everything they can within regulation that exists to take advantage of the data. And, you know, the irony is GDPR has emboldened them because it's fragmenting the rest of the market. They are a single domain. They're a single, you know, entity. They've got a single graph of knowledge. And, you know, I think it was Jeff Green that said last year about, you know, Facebook's invented easy. You know, that you can buy across 1.7 billion users. You know, having sat inside Facebook building them technology for 3 years, I can tell you their actual own internal knowledge of each of us is actually really poor. You know, if you compare it, this is the irony of the situation, is the publishers know way more about all of us in terms of our real world activities and our likes You know, from e-commerce, know all the things that we buy. Facebook, especially, you know, they cut off all ties with most third-party data because of the risks they were having with that. But it's still the fact that 80% of the spend goes to them because you've got a consistent, and it comes back to this ID thing, you've got a consistent ability to buy the right audience in the right place. And that's why they have 5 million buyers and the DSP market has 30,000, is because it's easy to just buy that correct segment and know you're definitely going to get in front of that right segment. But conversely, the publishers actually, if the right tech was there, and you know, the publishers actually have more eyeballs. Let's face it, the publishers have more eyeballs, better data, but they don't actually have a consistent way to create a face to the brands to buy them.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about sort of persistent ID, but it's a really good point about Facebook. You know, what is their data? And, you know, we have to remember, you know, that they're sort of quite parasitical in that manner. You know, those Facebook, those sharing buttons that appear on every publisher's site are scraping those pages and taking that data and then, you know, appending it to that user when that user next logs into Facebook. Mm. It's publisher data that's being taken. You know, social login, for example, you know, Facebook, they were genius. They went to market and said, don't worry about getting people to sort of sign into your website. We'll do it for you.
And they
took that data. You know, even things like tagging your friends on Facebook is training their sort of, you know, algorithms to do sort of facial recognition. You know, the data that they get is people say Facebook's got amazing data. It does, but it's taking it from elsewhere. It's not just their data. And so, you know, if people decided at some point that they didn't want to play so nicely with Facebook and wanted to close that down, they definitely wouldn't be in trouble, but they'd struggle. And actually, you're seeing that regulation, people like in Germany, for example, you know, they're sort of cracking down on Facebook sharing logins and data across its platforms. They're not keen on that, on the sort of the Facebook sharing, liking data on publishers' pages. They might be sort of shutting that down. So, you know, Facebook are going to find these things harder going forward, I would say.
But then we'll get onto this later. But kind of, then it kind of begs the question around scale and how you scale about that. Because obviously, talking about if Facebook weren't there and they're taking all the publishers' data, obviously heard from Damon Reed from the Ozone Project and Dora McCall from Telegraph just now, and talking about the Ozone Project and how that is that the answer to scalability to allow those publishers to be able to actually effectively almost compete with the likes of Facebook and be able to have like one kind of larger data play. Danny's shaking his head slightly.
I don't know, because I think I think it's dangerous to look at it that way, because we're looking at it from a very one-sided perspective.
Very true.
The reason advertisers like it is because they see their kids and their friends' friends on it, and it's that's one of the big things about it. Like, I mean, I'd love it to be a future where my mum knows what I do for a job and that she knows enough to know what Ozone Project's doing. But that reality isn't going to happen. She isn't going to log in to Ozone Project and tag her friend who's just found a dog down the road and is trying to find the owner. Do you know what I mean? That's not going to happen.
Insight to Danny's mum there.
But yeah, but at the same time, like, it's hard not to kind of want that to happen for publishers, like to remove the logins, to remove the share, and for them to do it themselves. But then you ask yourself, do I want to have that experience on every single publisher website? And do I want to have an individual login for every single publisher website? No. And am I going to share stuff like that? Probably not.
And the problem never was scale. I mean, you know, you look at the Comscore figures, every publisher has, you know, 20 to 30 million uniques a month. I mean, huge, huge scale. You know, Facebook works and it's easy. And it reaches the long tail of small businesses because it's very, very simple to create a sponsored post.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not going to change. They will always be expert at that.
Yeah.
That's not going away.
No, and I guess it's easy for everyone. It's easy for publishers to be able to get scale from Facebook. It's easy for advertisers to be able to run campaigns on Facebook and be able to, again, get scale. And it's easy for users to be able to see their universe. So I guess as long as Facebook has that, it's not going to change anytime soon. No. Anyway, on to the next story. This is about Criteo. Haven't talked about Criteo on the Mad Tech podcast much, but that's about to change. So retargeting is obviously what Criteo is famous for. And given the likes of GDPR and similar things in the US, like the CPPA, and just kind of more general data awareness, retargeting is kind of falling down a bit. So Criteo have announced their latest earnings call, and their profits are flat pretty much for the year. They're 1% up at $2.3 billion. But their CFO, Benoit Fouillon, does believe that that's a positive sign, because where they're looking for their revenue growth is in their non-retargeting products. For example, their acquisition of Hooklogic and the kind of the retail platform, those kinds of things a few years ago. Do we think that the growth they could see from those non-retargeting products is actually going to be scalable for them? Or do we, and do we think that retargeting is not the future for the companies like Criteo anymore? Thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, bottom line, you know, it was interesting. They made statements, obviously, around we're confident that Google will not go the same way as Safari. It's like, on what are you basing that?
That's actually a terrifying statement, because they are saying that, you know, obviously Safari launched ITP. That has hit us. That's hit us hard. But yeah. Safari's only small. Chrome's much bigger. Chrome won't do that, because that will then, you know, because they are also, they have their own tech stack, so they're not likely to do the same thing. But you can't guarantee that that's going to happen.
No, I think, haven't they just released something quite recently for the Chromium browser, which is called like Manifest V3, which is going to strip out quite a lot of capabilities, not necessarily for retargeting, because a lot of the ad block extensions and insight and analytics extensions are having to like kind of argue for that to Google. So, I don't think you could rule it out.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, you know, retargeting, there's maybe a bigger issue here around retargeting. I think as clients and publishers and other platforms get better at things like attribution modeling, I'm sure Criteo is a very robust business, but there's no doubt that there's things are going on in markets such as, you know, cookie bombing and false attribution, where, you know, which has benefited these retargeting companies. And I would like to think that one day we'll get to a position where we understand a proper brand attribution model, which understands what is actually impacting that user. And if that's the case, I suspect things like retargeting may be seen as less successful as they have been in the past.
And it's interesting, not to slate Criteo's business model in any way, shape or form, but they have had great success in going straight for the advertiser. They've not generally worked with agencies. In fact, they've could have made agencies enemies of agencies in most cases. Do you think they're historically where they kind of went for the advertiser but didn't really know what they were looking at, but just saw great results from retargeting, didn't know how that was impacting the user experience and the user's perception of those brands? Do you think that's also kind of coming to an end and changing the way Criteo's future?
Yeah, I think so. I think that started to happen. You saw like major retail advertisers like question how much they were giving Criteo even in 2017, and it only sped up in 2018. To your point around the fact that they've gone direct most of their kind of history, that's changed dramatically in 2018. Once ITP came in, suddenly there was like, okay, oh, there's a brand new agency sales team that just popped up at Criteo, and they're all
I did not know that.
Yeah, and there's loads of JBPs going around with Criteo at the moment. The thing that they are going to quite successfully tap into, though, which I think is why they're not that worried about retargeting, is they're kind of jumping on the back of this kind of surge in e-commerce opportunities at the moment that you're seeing in the marketplace. So there's a lot of conversation from them about e-commerce, which ultimately does just boil down to retargeting still.
Well, it is still retargeting. And also, to look at their figures in more detail, in 2017, when they launched this kind of new suite of products that were very centered around retail and e-commerce, they expected that within 3 years to have received 30% of their entire revenue would come from those new products, with the rest coming from retargeting. Year one, they got 9%. Year two, they got 13%.
Mm. That's it. So, and they're proud of that, though.
They are proud of that. And they've said, you know, we know we've got a long way to go. We're not quite where we wanted to be, but we know we're happy with how that's going. And they probably feel like retargeting is still buoyant enough for them. Yeah. They haven't got to worry about it too much.
I wouldn't ever doubt their ability to market a product very, very well. Because if you think back to, let's say, like 2011 or 2012, like the thing that was on everyone's tongues at that point was dynamic creative optimization, like DCO. And there was a raft of companies that were in the market offering DCO services. I can't remember all of them now, but I know a few of them vanished or was acquired into another business. And the reason for that, it was really kind of like almost, it's the Bryan Singer film, like the kind of the secret devil, like the devil that Criteo wanted you to believe was the devil was the DCO. But the reality was the way that Criteo acquired inventory was actually what was providing a lot of their power and their performance.
Yeah.
So the whole market got detracted to chasing this DCO myth, when the reality was they were just really sensible buyers and just actually locked up great quality inventory at a certain price well in advance when they needed it. So them being able to do that again with something as powerful and as like on the tip of every advertiser's tongue as e-commerce right now, I totally back them to do it.
But I've always thought, you know, what they do is just systematic of the failure of high quality ability to target. Because if the brand could actually buy the right audience in the right place across publishers, retargeting would, you know, it's such a, who likes it? You know, having things follow you around, it's just systematic of that we can't find the right people in the right place at the right time that you can on Facebook. That's what it comes to, you know, the fact that that it's still a thing says that the ecosystem isn't delivering what the brand wants in being able to get in front of the right people at the right time.
Yeah,
because otherwise it wouldn't exist.
I agree. It reflects what's sort of not working in marketing at the moment, which is, you know, retarget. It's easy to measure and it seems to work, so they just spend a lot of money on it. We all hate retargeting. Everyone knows that, but marketers still spend a huge amount of money on it because, you know, they can show their bosses that it shows a return.
But it comes down to just the technical side of it is that it's easy to do. You can track across cookies to, you know, get that delivered back in front of those people before they get lost in the, you know, lack of syncing somewhere else on the internet. And if there was, you know, like Facebook, if there was a more consistent way of finding the right people, you wouldn't need to use that kind of technique. It's just a failure of the way that, you know, the third-party cookie systems work.
Mm. And the scourge on every last-click attribution model that's ever existed, still exists everywhere. And also, I mean, what also interests me about Criteo is obviously they've always gone big on the retail and e-commerce platform side of things. Actually, when it comes to retargeting, they can only really do as much of the data that they're given, and retailers don't give them that much data. They don't give them cart data, they don't really give them abandonment data, they do to a certain degree. Don't give them sales data. So one of the reasons that we were being retargeted by things we actually bought 3 weeks ago is because Criteo haven't got the data to know we bought it or not. So why are retailers and why are advertisers and marketers in general still going down that road?
I really don't want to say this, but I think honestly, if you just look at like the mechanics of this, and I think I've talked about this before, like let's say Criteo just buys some inventory at 20p for 1,000, right? They then will sell that back to the client on a CPC basis of let's say 40p. Straight away, they've doubled their money. Every three clicks they get on there, they're going to keep tripling and quadrupling their money. So as long as the click becomes the most valuable thing to the client, which it was for a long time on Criteo. Like, it was just, like, honestly, an easy way to get into the business. No matter how hard you and the search team at Starcom at the time or me in the display team at Starcom at the time, like, kind of said to clients, like, you are literally doing the wrong thing here. Didn't matter. Like, and that's why they have, what's their war chest now? Like, 350 million that they can live off for, like, the next...
Yeah, 350 million war chest, yeah. So if they do, if things do all sink, they'll be all right for a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why clients, I think, did it. Sorry to interrupt.
That's right. But in the end, it comes back to what Damien was saying about Ozone. This is about the bridge of the right data, because, you know, everyone's obviously scared. You know, the elephant in the room is Amazon, their ability to have such a consistent view of the same graph of users like Facebook has, but they have the real power of that they have all the transactional data. And in the end, you can only bridge better targeting if you can bridge that gap between, you know, e-commerce sites who have, there's plenty of other independent e-commerce sites that have, you know, incredible data about what we're all buying, you know, and the brands that know who they want to buy and the publisher who has the eyeballs. It's the fact that those three parties right now don't trust each other. They can't bring that data together. GDPR has actually made it much, much harder. And that's what needs to be solved, because if you take all of those things together, you actually, you know, Facebook has nothing on that. You know, Facebook, if you ever look at what Facebook knows about each of us based upon the impression data it sees and the likes and all the buttons, there's actually a page, if you can go yourself and go on Facebook and look at what they know. They know very little. They don't know that, you know, I go to the gym every week at a particular place. They don't know what car I go and look on Auto Trader. You know, there's all of this first party data that is so much more potentially effective. They just have a consistent way of finding us, even if it's, you know, lower quality data. That's what needs to be fixed.
Until they go into commerce.
Yeah.
Well, Facebook have tried that a few times, haven't they, going into commerce? I don't know. I mean, you know, you're right. Someone like a Shopify, the data they hold is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, but you're right about GDPR. You know, publishers would love to sort of partner up with these people and sort of do, as I say, attribution modeling in a, and show cause and effect and get basically the credit for what they're doing at the top of the funnel. But we just can't. Those systems just can't talk to each other at the moment.
Yeah.
So actually, Amazon is a threat we should be looking at. Amazon, I mean, Nick, you just called them the elephant in the room.
Well, they are just, you know, it's, if you look at how quick they're built, can build technology, it's scary. You know, they are, you know, if you, the number of, they've got hundreds of tech products, it's not, you know, that's not a challenge to them. And, you know, the growth we've already seen in what they're capable of doing is, you know, they are capable of encroaching massively on, I believe, on what Facebook and Google are doing. And with Alexa at the same time, I mean, it's just incredible data.
And Alexa will be powering Facebook's new smart home product as well. So actually they're penetrating other tech giants' companies too. And interestingly, Amazon tends to build their stuff, whereas everybody else tends to buy it.
Yep.
So they're building it from the ground up and knowing exactly what they want and not buying something then making it redundant. So it's a very, very fascinating company to watch. Anyway, yep. On to the third story, which isn't really a story, which isn't not a new story. It was written by Ronan Shields at Adweek, and reminding us that second-party data is actually pretty cool. And that actually there'll be a resurgence of second-party data, and you know, particularly things like GDPR and CCPA again will fuel the rise of second-party data. And you know, essentially, second-party data is kind of resold first-party data, and it will could render third-party data technically fairly useless. Do we think that third-party data could be coming to an end?
I think it's going to get a dent. Yeah, it's going to get a pretty significant dent in its business if it hasn't already from things like GDPR.
Yeah. I'm sure it has. Nobody will admit the numbers, yeah, but I'm sure it has.
Yeah. On second-party data specifically, though, like, I think there's a lot of people in the industry who really want that to be a success. But the realities of it right now, as far as I'm aware, and I would, you know, love to hear bigger, more examples of this, is it hasn't been executed very well, and it hasn't been done at scale anywhere, really.
It's the scale. The scale is the issue here.
Yeah.
And again, obviously, we talked about Ozone Project and that kind of being the potential answer scale, and lots of, from a publisher perspective, lots of data co-ops. Actually, also from the advertiser perspective, it's not all about looking at publisher data. It's about, you know, if you look in retail, is a great example, looking at retailers and brands, manufacturers sharing their data that way, and there being greater examples of that. But it's tough to do, right? Very tough to do.
Totally. I think actually it's even harder now than it was to do,
yeah,
you know, a couple of years ago. The Holy Grail, I think everyone, it used to be banded around the industry so much, it was like, I think it was a Mediacom, Dell and Intel tie-up, where Dell and Intel were like swapping data to build this kind of great target mechanic. It was a really, really good example, and everyone tried to replicate it within their agency holding company and their offerings. The reality was that no client really is happy about sharing their data, and that was a couple of years ago. Like, if you had someone who was building and launching and marketing films, the natural progression is to tie up with a cinema, but the idea of getting that to work was almost impossible. And now let's just throw GDPR into the mix. Because that is going to make it even more harder. You're handling that data and you're giving it to someone else. Like, there's so many things you have to facilitate now to do it. But I think there's intermediaries that exist now that can allow that to happen a little bit more easier and a little more fluidly. But I still think I've yet to see like a great example executed at scale of second-party data.
I agree. You need that sort of that the business needs to exist that can hold that data in a sort of a centralized place and sit above all these sort of different parties that can't talk to each other at the moment. My worry is that might end up being the browser, i.e. Google. And, you know, would they even want to play in that? Would they want to benefit the ecosystem in that way? But that does need, GDPR means that we do need this sort of consent management system that sits above all these sites. But, you know, Ozone, if you believe that what people choose to read in their own spare time, not what they share or like, but what they actually choose to read, is a great indicator of who they are and what they're into, then the first party data that Ozone will hold, and, you know, the publishers themselves, is incredibly powerful. Mm. And there's no problem with scale there. Absolutely no problem with scale. So there's huge potential.
Interesting. And Nick, kind of talking about the platform that could hold the second party data that is not a DMP redefined, yep, or reimagined. It's a data platform in of itself. And actually it's pipes that don't touch the data. They just kind of are able to bring it together and share it across the different platforms. How's that working in practice? How's that actually working in practice?
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's what we're trying to do at InfoSum is basically bridge those trust barriers across data is by, and we talk about this key concept of non-movement of data is bridging across any number of consumer data sets where each party doesn't actually have to give the raw data to each other. Because, yeah, that you know, the GDPR has stopped the idea that you can have a big central repository. And the way, in fact, you know, going back to this whole way that the competing of second-party data with what the way third-party data looks at the moment is, the third-party segments that get generated right now, by definition, have to be kind of GDPR safe, and that therefore means the way they get generated is a kind of a, I kind of think of them as this kind of one-dimensional set of users. It's just literally an anonymous list of IDs of who you hope, you know, that Sainsbury's might define of the, I call it the happy shopper segment, but you actually don't have no idea who's inside that, and you can't make any changes to that segment. You can't take any of the powers that you have inside Facebook to do that kind of bespoke targeting that the brand really would like to have and like the brand would like to be able to overlay their data within. None of those things are, you know, capable in the current ecosystem. And, you know, that's, you know, fundamentally what we're trying to change is bring that power of Facebook to all the publishers. Because if you remove all of the technical barriers, all of the privacy barriers of everyone being able to work together without actually having to share their raw data with each other, you basically get that combined, both that combined ID graph of every publisher that's involved, you get the attribute knowledge of every single publisher combined, but without the GDPR issue of the fact it's all being stuck in one big pot. You know, that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do. It's, you know, it's very early days, but the, you know, the technology is there, and it's, you know, it's already you know, making those bridges between, you know, publishers.
And obviously you're talking about making bridges between publishers. Kind of in what use cases do you see this being like a really effective answer to kind of not fighting against, but navigating spend around the duopoly or the walled gardens? And are we talking about creating a whole other walled garden?
Well, I think, you know, every publisher has a certain sensitivity of how they think about who would want to be in their own walled garden. But I think there's overlaps between sets of walled gardens that can be made to happen, where certain sets of data may want to be shared within a certain group, but maybe not, you know, wide across everyone. But I think where everyone would like to be able to be consistent is that single knowledge of that one person. You know, that's the key point here is, and however that's achieved in terms of trying to solve the, you know, the single login, the important bit is that you know, everyone starts to think, you know, we've got to start collaborating if we are going to really compete. And I think that it in the end, you know, it's driven by the brands as well. The brands do want to start to use their own data. They're getting much more advanced in their use of their own data, and they're like, well, why can't I use this? And you know, part of that is, you know, is a trust element. Is if I've got a whole load of transactional knowledge about my own customers, I'm not going to hand that into a central repository again. I'm just never going to do that. So it's bridging that gap. You know, certainly, you know, our vision is certainly, you know, is first party at the brand, first party at the publisher, because if you can bridge those two things together, that's what makes the publisher more valuable than Facebook or Google.
And we talked, and you mentioned it yourself just now about kind of single login, single sign-on, and we talked about Facebook doing it, Google doing it, even LinkedIn, Twitter, they all have their own single sign-on mechanisms. Is that what we're trying to strive for other for publishers outside of those companies? Are we looking for the single sign-on? Is that the holy grail, the answer?
It's going to be hard to, you know, get, not every publication is suited to be able to have it, is it, in the end?
No.
You know, I think there's everyone is moving towards that direction to have a certain percentage of their user base. And then that's all in the end, that's about incentivizing, isn't it? It's about, you know, the best publishers creating environments where there's, you know, you give them that reason. I think the thing that everyone has to think about is, do you just piggyback on, you know, Facebook's or Google's graph? Because in the end, you're just continuing to empower them. You know, and whether that ends up being a group of publishers get together again across various boundaries to say, you know, we're going to make it so that we have a single publisher sign on. You know, there's plenty of technologies that would make that happen. It just needs a commitment across a certain number of publishers to make it happen.
And so, the purpose of this podcast is kind of looking at the beyond the cookie, the future identity. Identity and how we would define identity has drastically changed, particularly since 25th of May last year. Kind of, in 2019, how are we defining identity now? What does identity mean to each of you?
I mean, pre-GDPR, there was lots of talk about people taking back control of their data. And by that, I think it means...
Especially publishers.
Well, publishers, but the user, actually, you know, the actual individual who is browsing these websites. In theory, you know, the talk was that GDPR would allow you as a web browser to take back control of your data. Now, I don't know anyone who even knew what that meant, really.
And I don't know anyone who's even more confused now.
Yeah, and I don't know anyone who's doing that. But, you know, it was a lovely idea that the user themselves would be able to control that. Now, you know, that would still be incredibly valuable if it was, you know, if someone said, you know, I'm going to go on the internet today and actually I'm in the market for a car, so I'll tell the internet I'm in the market for a car so that every ad I get is actually relevant to me, for example, or I want to turn off retargeting here, or I want you to know this about me but not that about me. You know, the identity sort of is owned by the user.
But the user was never told that taking control of your own data, they all believe that it means you'll stop seeing annoying ads. Actually, you'll just see, they were never told, you'll just see ads less relevant to you. I love arguably that making them more annoying than they already were.
I remember reading a story, it was a long time ago now, but there was something in the Apple T's and C's, which was, you know, we target advertising to you. If you want to turn this off, you can. You won't see less adverts, you'll just see less relevant adverts. And then you think, well, from the user's point of view, then what's the benefit?
Why am I bothering?
I think, you know, the future of identity, I'd like to think, and this is probably quite some way away, is that the future of identity is owned by the user. The user controls what people do and don't know about them. They accept that they're going to see ads, but hopefully it means the ads are more interesting and relevant. You know, being spammed with retargeting dies because actually the user can then say, I have bought this product. You know, you could literally just tell whatever this sort of consent management system is that you've bought a product, or it knows because it's linked to your credit card, for example, so it can see that you've bought the product. And so those retargeting ads get turned off. You know, that's how these things should work. It should be the user has that control.
Yeah.
Now, we're a long, long way from that.
Oh, yes.
But that would solve a huge number of the problems that persist within the digital ecosystem if that platform did exist.
I mean, look, end users want convenience. You know, I hate the fact that with GDPR in place, I have to click accept 10 times a day.
Yep.
What that's not great, is it? And the reality is when I click accept, I'm getting 1,000, you know, because of the CMP market, I'm getting 1,000 other sites that I've suddenly given supposedly permission to cross-pollinate a whole load of things. It's like, I didn't agree to that. That's actually done the reverse of what I wanted. I want to... you know, we all accept that we're getting free services and I want to be able to just, you know, browse the internet. What I don't like is that I don't know where my data is going. And, you know, and a principle of GDPR was, you know, me being able to go and ask someone for, what do you hold about me? Can you delete what you hold about me? And that's a fallacy right now. You know, an utter fallacy. I'd rather have no accept buttons, but be able to enforce much more strongly that any company that I'm, you know, the website I'm on isn't giving my data to 100 other, you know, in the way that they are do right now. You know, the raw, you know, the way I think about the raw data sharing market is still, you know, incredibly pervasive. And we have no controls over that as an individual user. You know, I, if I'm on a site and I'm getting value out of that, I'm on the Top Gear site, I'm enjoying their content, they can send show me adverts. What I don't like is the fact that that can then be used in, you know, 100 other places without me knowing about it.
You've all talked about cars. You've talked about Auto Trader, Top Gear. We're massive car fans here.
No.
Great. Cool. Good examples.
I was going to add on to that. I've kind of got like these two ways of thinking about it in my head. And there's one way which is like, it'd be very nice if in the future to use the internet, you had to have, you know, almost a driving license to use it, which would be linked to, you know, your identity, your interests, your behaviors, and you can edit that and you can change it and you can tweak it. But then the kind of like the conspiracy theorist in me thinks, okay, well, someone can now start to pretend to be someone else, like if it's not something that's regulated. And there's nothing that the industry or actually anyone hates more is than like a troll who you don't know who they are, but they're just doing what they want. That could turn into that. But then at the same time, the other side of me is like, you know, it'd still be good if this was like an open, free environment where you didn't need to have an identification to use something that was never built to be a kind of licensed, required medium. So I don't know what the answer is, but either way, there's positives and negatives. There's negatives if we all become license holders to use the internet with an ID and a profile attached to it, because then, you know, that could be used for God knows what. Do we want our government?
Black Mirror as well,
yeah.
Really,
do we want that? I don't think so. And then the other side of it is, we've got to solve all these problems that we have with control of data, with misuse of it, with tracking the right people and understand what's going on. But there still needs to be some order there. But at the same time, we still need to make it open and free. It could be that right now we're trying to have these conversations and the technology, the way that we interact with the internet and digital as a whole is actually too archaic to even solve that problem with. You know, what if the way that we go about it is, got, you know, something like Ready Player One, where it is a whole second life. I don't know, but my point is, I don't know if what we're trying to solve right now will be solved in the current confines of the industry as we know it, or the environment of digital as we know it.
The trouble is that the people that control the browsers actually have it in their power to solve this. In the irony really is, look, mobile has a single ID, although in theory it's resettable, and how many people in the audience actually know how to reset it? So we're being tracked on our mobile phones as a single identity 100 times better than we are on the web. All the browsers could generate a single ID, forget all cookie types, and literally have a reported single ID that was resettable like it is in the mobile. Why is that not happening? Because if Google let that happen, it would give the power of the single ID to every publisher. So they're never going to ever make that happen.
Well, they've got too many horses in the race, really, haven't they?
Yeah.
Does that mean that it's not going to happen? Because as long as Google are around, and you know, Apple's stake is increasing as well, particularly in terms of what they're trying to do with their news business, are we just kind of allowing them even more power? And does that mean we're never really going to resolve this?
And it's because government doesn't understand, you know, clearly. GDPR, you know, the EU didn't understand the implications of what it did in reality, because obviously if you proposed a single ID for web browsing, the privacy people would be up in arms, when actually the reverse would actually be better for everyone, because if you had that single ID, you could basically remove, you know, if that's then resettable, or just completely you could turn it off. You literally have, you know, black and white ability to change that. But again, it's not in the interest of Google to do it. Apple is its own entity around, you know, they have mixed messaging about how they say that, you know, privacy safe around mobile ID, but actually, you know, they could be doing the same for their browser, while at the same time they're enjoying attacking the cookie side of things. So I don't see it happening, but that should be the solution, because then no publisher would need login.
The other thing as well, if it was a government thing, you'd never trust the government with it. Like, does anyone here actually know the...
As a regulation if you were trying to make a level playing... If the EU was trying to make a level playing field to make publishers compete with Google and Facebook, that's the one thing they should do to make the level playing field.
I wouldn't trust them, their ability to do it, though. Does anyone here know their government gateway ID?
I knew that's what you were going to say, government gateway.
Does anyone know that?
Not a clue.
No. It's crazy. Like, it's a big number in your life. No one knows it.
Actually, I tried it recently. I have a card with my ID on it, and it actually was the wrong ID. So there's no chance. Absolutely no chance. So kind of moving away from the kind of identity conversation, but kind of looking at more the broader data piece. And we talked about first-party data and leveraging that more, and then second-party data and how we scale it. Let's go back to first-party data for a second and talk about how we can actually make the most of what we have at our disposal. And that comes from a buyer perspective and from a publisher perspective. Is there more that we can be doing with what we've already got kind of sitting in our own databases?
Yeah, I think so. I actually think many clients are trying to do that right now. I think I've spoken about this before as well. Like, clients have seen companies like Uber, like Netflix, like Amazon, like a few others, direct-to-consumer companies who have very granular information on the people that they're marketing to and great depth of records on those people at the same time. And many of the traditional advertisers right now are saying, I want that. I want that in my business. I want to try and get to that as quickly as possible. How do I get there? And then you've had the raft of digital transformation PR that we've seen in the marketplace. So I think everyone's trying to get to that point. Some I don't think are going to make it. Like, I don't genuinely think that you will see a couple of marketers that we kind of love and hold dear right now. I just don't think they'll make the transition because their product just isn't that type of product. But I think most are trying to get there. Most are trying to get to a situation where their first-party data is so valuable and so well kind of stored and kind of taxonomized and given the right hierarchy, that they can drive the right insights and powers from it at the same time.
They're always going to be limited. I mean, you know, if a client's building first-party data based on what they see within their ecosystem, that ecosystem can be quite narrow. You know, they might have a website selling a particular product. All they may know about that user is how many times they've bought that product. So, that, you know, there'll always be a demand for... clients will always have a demand for other companies to come in and say, you know, these 10,000 people that have been on that page or taken that action... Let's append some more information to that user. You can go to a publisher and say, well, tell me what kind of topics they're interested in. You know, who are their favorite celebs? What are their favorite TV shows? They could go to any number of other companies and say, here's a bucket of people. What can you tell me about them? Now, again, the current ecosystem isn't really facilitating that, but really that's what clients want. You know, and really that's what custom audiences was. And again, Facebook got there first, right? They did that 7 years ago. Upload your custom audiences into Facebook and they will allow you to profile them through the Facebook Insights tool. They've actually turned that off now, I think. But really that's the beauty of first and second party data, is that if we can work together, we could add value to all those first party data buckets. And again, publishers would be in a really strong position to do that.
And is the value of first party and second party data here kind of for brands and publishers as well, kind of particularly those that are trying to compete against challenger brands that are doing so well with their first party data, that many of whom are advertisers and publishers kind of in their own right, kind of creating their own ecosystem and actually changing the game completely? Are they the ones that are giving the example of, this is what you can do with data, and this is how and other companies are using it as a business transformation tool, not just a digital transformation tool, but actually to actually completely redevelop their businesses? You mentioned kind of the sort of companies that you don't think will be here that are product-led reasons really rather than business reasons. Do you think that that's going to be the case for many of the challenger brands as well, though? Like, how far can they go with their own first-party data and then seeding in the second-party data as well? There's got to be a limit.
I think their limit is as big a population as they can store.
Right.
And then it just becomes, okay, well, do we buy another company to set up a new offering? I mean, I think Amazon did a great job on Prime Video. Like, they set up the e-commerce and then they're like, hey, just sign up and get the streaming service. Like, I think what could Netflix do? I mean, it's got incredible amounts of debt, so not much at the moment other than just keep building content.
Yeah.
But my point is, like, they could maybe pivot into something else. They could maybe acquire a separate business that they could become part, use the insight. And I mean, if I was a production company right now in film, I would be asking Netflix for what people are watching every single day so that I could craft film and pieces of content that basically answer their every need. That would have a part with them. So Netflix becoming an insight generation tool for film production companies, great idea. But I think they'll be around and they'll find ways to pivot. I don't know if our kind of more traditional businesses will. Like, you think about the infrastructure and the cost that goes into building a car. Like, look at Elon Musk and what he's had to do with Tesla, and you know, it's taken him a long time. But look at Ford, look at any of the big auto brands. Like, to change their entire infrastructure that much to the point where they become almost the same as someone like a Netflix, like, the costs on that are unfathomable and difficult. So some of them might not make it. Every one of them is talking right now about having connected cars by 2025. It's a big statement.
Let's face it, you know, it's for the brands to use their own data. They need to have their data in, you know, the right shape to start off with. You know, not you know, there's plenty of companies that, you know, the internal setups are just not ready to, you know, take advantage of it. And it comes back to that whole thing about Facebook audiences. If Facebook made it easy, you know, and that's why they have five million buyers. And that's what this industry needs, is just, bottom line is, you know, most business success comes from making things easy. That's why retargeting is because it's easy. And if we're going to move forward, it's about removing the barriers to make things like this happen. You know, that's, you know, what we do, our whole... everything InfoSum is doing is just trying to knock down those barriers of the bridges of how would a brand bring first-party data into a publisher. If you can remove the barrier of GDPR, if you remove the barrier of the fear of handing my most valuable data over, you can. Can you remove a lot of the you know, technical challenges? Then you can start to change the conversation. It's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, that's what's got to happen. It's not to do with how the real-time bidding systems work. Most of this is about identity, getting together, as you say. Even if you've got smaller publishers with very small subsets of knowledge, it's getting over that bridge of that small subset of data is valuable to someone, And how do they then become part of an ecosystem where I can leverage that 10,000 users and target them as easy as I can on Facebook?
I think, you know, these things are getting easier. You know, a client who invests in a next generation sort of real-time DMP, I'm sure the next step for these DMPs is to partner up or even acquire some kind of panel-based company where within the DMP itself, you can then start to say, right, here's a group of people. This panel then tells me that these people are this age and this gender and have these interests and these behaviours. And, you know, all the hard bits that had to be sort of plugged together a couple of years ago can all be done in one place now. You know, these DMPs are building excellent data visualization layers that anyone can use. You know, that was often the bottleneck for a lot of people was, I've got the data, but how do I see it? You know, how do I manipulate it? All these things are now being baked into these next-gen DMPs. So that will all be there, but again, it will be narrowly focused on, you know, that what that client is able to sort of generate themselves. You'll still need that sort of second party data to sort of add color and clarity to who these people are and how to communicate with them. And it's not even just, you know, for advertising, it's, you know, what should my PPC strategy be? What should my SEO strategy be? Who should my brand ambassadors be? You know, all that stuff will come to light if you could enrich that data with publisher data or whatever second party data you wish.
And outside of the second and third party data conversation, is there also a question being asked around how can I also enrich my first party data and get more of it that's more diversified? And we, you know, we talk about publisher diversification. Danny, you talked about kind of brands buying kind of other brands that are similar or different, and obviously the big CPGs are doing things like that, like Grays has been bought and Dollar Shave Club, for example, Unilever. They're bringing themselves more diversified data into the mix as well, and it's really rich first party data. Is that also an answer for publishers and for marketers to be able to say, okay, this is more valuable to me, and actually this can help me even more so when I'm looking at my second and third party data strategies? If I've got this level of first party data to work with, it's just going to make my data strategy so much stronger in the long run.
Yeah, totally. I think so. Yeah. I mean, the more that you can get that kind of critical set of first party data, bigger, more powerful, more scaled, like the better you're going to be in driving insights across this. I mean, that's what we tell every advertiser every day right now when they come to us with a retargeting pool of 300. You know, we're like, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
or an email database of 250, like, that's not going to work. So yeah, absolutely, I totally agree with that statement.
Are you still having those conversations with clients?
No, thankfully not.
Right, I was going to say, okay.
But I remember them.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, okay, interesting. I want to kind of leave it there because I think we could go on about this all day, and I think we're running out of time, but I want to say thank you very, very much for listening and watching to this week's episode of the Magic Podcast, and thank you very much to my guests, Nick, Danny and Badir.
Thank you.